This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th Century History Guy.
Give me liberty or give me death. One of the most famous catchphrases from American history, uttered on the eve of the Revolutionary War by radical patriot Patrick Henry. It's the closing line of a speech that helped convince his fellow Virginians to take up arms against King George.
Less well known is a speech Henry gave 10 years earlier, but that speech may have been the real opening volley of the Revolution. Tarquin and Caesar had each his Brutus, Henry declared at its conclusion. Charles I, his Cromwell, and George III may profit by their example. What drove Patrick Henry to taunt his king with threats of assassination? Why, a new tax, the stamp tax, levied by Parliament on the colonists in America.
More than 250 years later, it seems that Patrick Henry's spirit is alive and well in America. Lawmakers impose new taxes at their own peril. And even though we're now governed by elected officials, protesters still accuse our leaders of taxation without representation. People pause and they say, well, look, our income tax burden is lower than it's been in three decades. And other people point out that taxpayers in almost every other industrialized nation fork over far more of their incomes to the government than we do. But still, taxation feels like a real problem in this country.
On today's show, we're going to take a closer look at the history of American attitudes about taxes. Is our distaste for them an inheritance from the colonial era? Or can we point to other events since then that have fed our suspicion of the tax man? Are there times when Americans are willing to embrace high levels of taxation?
We're going to begin by returning to Patrick Henry, literally, considering what a prominent role he plays in the history and mythology of American taxation. We thought it might be interesting to hear straight from the horse's mouth, so I headed down to Colonial Williamsburg here in Virginia, where Patrick Henry and his contemporaries live on. Well, sort of.
Why, this is Patrick Henry.
Good morrow, sir.
Right.
Indeed.
Peter Onuf from Charlottesville.
Well, Charlottesville, sir. One of my very worthy friends and longtime associates is of that place.
Well, you know, we've spoken, and...
After a little small talk about our mutual friend Thomas Jefferson, Henry and I strolled over to Williamsburg's Capitol building. Now, if you've ever been to Colonial Williamsburg, you know that the 18th century never ended there. So imagine, if you will, that the year is 1765. Mr. Henry is a 29-year-old lawyer just elected to the House of Burgesses. On his ninth day in town, he goes to the House floor to denounce Parliament's recent Stamp Act, an act which imposes a tax on colonists who are using official documents, colonists like newspapermen and lawyers.
Resolved, therefore, that the General Assembly of this colony have the only and sole exclusive right and power to lay taxes and impositions upon the inhabitants of this colony, and that every attempt to vest such power in any person or persons whatsoever other than the General Assembly aforesaid has a manifest tendency to destroy British as well as American freedom.
Not all of Henry's fellow Virginians agree with him. Many point out that the Stamp Act was an attempt by Britain to recoup its costs from the Seven Years' War, a war that kept the French out of the Virginia backcountry. But to Patrick Henry, that was beside the point. The point was that as British subjects, the colonists had the right to be taxed only with their consent. So he waited until most of his fellow legislators had left Williamsburg, and then took to the floor to make the case to those remaining that they reject the new tax. And they did, by a margin of one vote. This was the speech where Patrick Henry made that assassination remark we mentioned earlier, a remark that supposedly elicited accusations of treason. But when I sat down with Mr. Henry in that very same Capitol building where this went down, he insisted he was speaking as a loyal British subject.
Sir, the people of Virginia have always been the most faithful and affectionate of subjects to His Majesty the King. And we will happily show His Majesty all of our allegiance and our obedience so long as we are enjoying the same full rights, liberties, privileges, franchises, and immunities.
Well, excuse me, I don't mean to challenge your statement here, and it's obviously something you believe in deeply. But how heavily taxed are you, in fact, compared to British taxpayers?
Well, sir, I will remind you that Here in Virginia, we are still reeling from the debts incurred by the late war, which just concluded 2 years ago. There's some 500,000 pounds of paper money which is outstanding, must be redeemed. And we are not reeling so heavily, admittedly, as are our cousins in Great Britain. I'm given to understand that their taxes are some 8 times greater than ours.
Yes, indeed. Isn't there a claim that there should be equal taxation throughout the empire? Don't you benefit from the great expense that the British government incurred in the recent war against the French that's created opportunities for you Virginians that are just outstanding, astonishing?
Oh, I warrant you, sir, there were some numbers of British redcoats in the late war against the French, but who was it who dropped their arms and ran upon hearing the war whoops of the savages coming from the trees? I submit to you, sir, that we Virginians fought alongside, and even with a greater measure of valiance than did those British redcoats. We don't want them here, we don't need them here. We are quite capable of protecting and defending ourselves.
Mr. Henry, doesn't British maritime strength protect you and your crops and your people in the Atlantic world? Could you survive without the great power of the mother country?
Oh, our ships laden with tobacco, sir, and all of these other natural riches of this bountiful country are indeed protected by the British Navy. But to whose benefit? Is it to the benefit of the poor planter here in Virginia? Oh, no, sir. I submit it is to the benefit of those fat London merchants and those in Bristol who are taking the lion's share of any profits to be realized as a result of our trade.
Excuse me, Mr. Henry. I've been traveling around the Old Dominion and observing the style of life of the planters of Virginia. They seem to live quite well, don't they?
It is true that here in Williamsburg City, at least, the taverns in the evenings are filled with a great many gentlemen who are frivolously gambling away their monies. There are men such as Colonel Byrd, for example, who is only happy when he has a box of dice in his hands. I'm not of that number, however. And furthermore, I should wish to say to you, sir, that I represent the people of the back country. There are a great many small farmers throughout the whole of this country who are not given to such dissipation and extravagance as are these eastern aristocrats here in the Tidewater.
The militancy of your position is apparent, and clearly you are speaking to a continental audience, and that you are imagining a situation in which Americans collectively could dictate to the British imperial government what its policy should be. I want to ask you once more, though, do you acknowledge that American colonists owe any debt to Britain? Do they have any obligations to the British imperial state?
We have met our obligations in prior years, sir, by answering royal requisitions. We have understood that as subjects to the crown, that we must pay some part in the debts incurred for the good of king and empire, and this we did. I remind you respectfully, sir, that during the late war with the French, we received and answered to the farthing 14 royal requisitions. Something has changed, however, in 1763 with the Treaty of Paris. Now, instead of requesting monies to be raised from the burgesses, now they are insisting that they have the right to tax us directly. We cannot allow that precedent to be established, for where would it end?
That's Patrick Henry, the firebrand legislator and future governor of Virginia. He spoke to us with the help of his spirit medium, Richard Schumann, a reenactor at Colonial Williamsburg. You can listen to a longer version of my interview with him at backstoryradio.org. And if you want to ask Mr. Henry a question, put it in an email and send it to backstory@virginia.edu. We'll pass it along to him and post his response on our website.
Hey, Peter, if I'm not wrong, it sounds like there's more at stake than just a tax revolt here.
I think that's right, Brian. It is certainly a tax revolt because taxes are all over the place in the run-up to the revolution, but a tax revolt that makes taxation legitimate because every tax that you specify as illegitimate for a particular reason, no representation,
right,
then you've provided the answer of how you can exact legitimate taxes and how you might raise the level of taxation. That is, you don't do the things that set the people off.
Right.
By, in effect, bringing the government home and by making our governors responsible to us, we govern ourselves, then we have done the major thing that modern states have to do to make taxation legitimate.
But, Peter, it seems to me that we had a pretty sweet deal as far as taxation, right? All those Indian wars, didn't the British pretty much pay for all of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's crucial. And a lot of historians have argued that the American tax levels went way up because of independence. So if Americans really wanted to escape high taxes, they should have just rolled over and paid the stamp tax. You know, there's a wonderful irony here because with the territorial government system and the first phases of Western development, it's Eastern states that are subsidizing these
right.
new Western settlements that they cost plenty, believe me.
Those Easterners, they've basically become the British.
Right.
They're providing services. They're providing subsidized land. And the people out there are not paying much taxes.
But meanwhile, those Western economies develop and they achieve independence, that is statehood. And then suddenly they find out that they have to pay taxes. You know, there are tax resistance movements in the territories against statehood. Because they'll have to pay taxes.
Sure. Well, they learn the lesson of the British.
Right. In a way, the question is the visibility and invisibility of taxation. And in the crucial early periods of American colonial history and then territorial history, tax levels are not visible. That is, because other people are paying. There's a transfer of wealth from Britain to the colonies in order to provide security and expansion and so forth. And the beneficiaries are not aware
of those
costs.
And then from the East to those Westerners.
Right.
Now, Ed, I want to ask you about another transfer of tax burden, if you will. If I'm not mistaken, slaves were taxed?
Slaves were the foundation of the entire Southern economy. And if you're a part of the three-fourths of white Southerners who don't own slaves before the Civil War, you are kind of getting a bargain because the one-fourth of white Southerners who do own human property are paying the great majority of the taxes of the slave South. But as Peter said before, the problem comes when the taxes become visible.
Yeah.
And when they do become visible, we get a major tax revolt, what became known as the nullification crisis.
It's tax season in America, and we're marking the occasion with a look back at attitudes towards taxation over the past three centuries. When we left off, Peter and Ed were talking about the differences between visible taxes and invisible taxes. And that brings us to a subject that has glazed over many generations' worth of eyelids, the tariff. Wouldn't you say, guys, that for a while at least, this was the kind of ultimate invisible tax, so invisible that maybe you better tell me what the heck it is?
Well, very simply, Brian, the tariff is duties on imported goods collected at the water's edge by the customs house. And in effect, you could say those imported goods are luxuries. We don't need them. We virtuous Americans. And if we're produced for ourselves, we don't have to buy these European gewgaws. And let the rich people pay the duty. So it had the feeling of a progressive tax, and it had the feeling of an invisible tax. That is because it's folded into the ultimate cost to the consumer. It's not something they're aware of paying. It was an indirect tax, and it was the mainstay of American government in the early 19th century. It was the chief source of revenue.
Yeah, but let me guess that some people liked it more than others.
Well, the great thing about a tariff is it protects some people, and it protects manufacturers who then have a wall against the imported goods
okay,
that they're competing
the
with.
They're in the North, right?
Right, right.
All right.
But the people who don't like it are people who rely heavily for their way of life on exports and then on imports in exchange. People like Southern cotton producers who are shipping directly to European markets, and they want free trade if they can get it. Free trade means that you're going to get maximum dollar return for your product. But if you have to pay heavy import duties on imported manufacturers, then somebody else is benefiting.
Okay,
you're
Peter.
Paying a tax,
Time
right?
for a fact yeah. check here. You're talking 19th century.
Oh, yeah,
you're talking
yeah.
South.
Right.
Let's go to our man
yes,
in the 19th century South, Edward Ayers.
I'm sitting here doing a slow burn. I'm just thinking about that.
Everything's slow in the South, Ed.
Yeah, well, not our revolt against the tariff. Because there in the late 1820s, early 1830s, we see right through this thing and realize that this is a conspiracy.
It's an abomination.
It is abominable tariff. And what it's doing is lining the pockets of rich Yankee industrialists while the good salt of the earth planters in the South are being exploited.
The good slave owning salt of the earth planters.
Yeah, well, that's right. How is you going to produce all that cotton? And so we come up with a plan we call nullification in South Carolina. And it says that any state can nullify the effect of a national law within its own borders. And so what we're going to do is just not pay attention to those taxes here in our state. We're going to nullify them.
Wow.
Make a long story short, Andy Jackson, even though he's a fellow Southerner, says, you will not nullify that law, and you will pay that tariff. Because if I lose the power to tax, I've really lost the authority of the federal government. You're not going to do that. So we lose. Decades go by, the 1830s, the 1840s, 1850s, the slow burn continues. We continue to be furious at the way that it seems to us that the taxation is just stacked against us.
And is it fair to say, Ed, that one of the prices the South paid for losing the Civil War was that that tariff stayed?
Oh, it was jacked up.
Yes, if you have the bad taste to bring that up. That's the way it went. Yeah, and really, for the next 50 years after the Civil War, the tariff becomes really synonymous with the Republicans in the North, who are kind of like the stereotypical Democrats of today. They're the big government people. They're tax and spend, or in this case, tariff and spend. And what they're using it for is to build up the power of the federal government, especially with pensions for Union veterans and so forth. So through the whole 19th century, the tariff is a really volatile issue. There's a historian at Vassar College named Rebecca Edwards, and she's written about how gender played into debates about the tariff in the second half of the 19th century. I sat down with her recently, and she explained that politicians on both sides framed their positions as being best for the American family.
You have a lot of men in the 1880s, for example, claiming that women want lower tariffs or women want higher tariffs. But since women themselves don't get to go to the polls and make a decision, it's a little hard to say. But certainly one of the real linchpins of the Republican pro-tariff argument is that it protects the American family. And by that they mean manufacturers can pay a higher wage to workers, to male workers, and women don't need to work outside the home for wages. And the Republicans spend a lot of time pointing to what they say are the sort of horrors of free trade England, where they say, you know, women are working in mines and forges stripped to the waist and their babies are wandering around on the floor neglected because they are doing these low-wage jobs that are very degrading for women. And you see this all over the place in Republican rhetoric. Benjamin Harrison, when he's running for president in 1888, gives this speech to recent Irish immigrants. And he says, you know, you came here because you wanted to have your wives and daughters protected by the tariff.
Contrast the American mother and wife, burdened only with the cares of motherhood and of the household, with the condition of a woman in many of the countries of the old world, where she is loaded also with the drudgery of toil in the field. I know that none more than Irishmen who are so characterized by their deference to women will value this illustration of the good effects of our American system upon the home life.
Now, very few Irish people actually went for the Republican arguments, right? So what was the counter argument to the tariff, and what would be the argument against Benjamin Harrison?
Well, it's clearly a big fight over working men's votes, and you see both parties trying to appeal to recent immigrants and to working men. And the Democrats, probably more successfully, as you suggest, go after the consumer argument. And they say, look, every time your family, is you as a working man and working family, every time you go down to the store and buy something, you're paying more because of the tariff. And they run all these cartoons showing how luxury goods like silk and velvet have a lower tariff rate than basic goods like tin and cotton cloth and things of that sort. So they say, look, this is doubly bad because the kinds of things that the Vanderbilt family is buying or the Carnegie family are not taxed as heavily. So it's incredibly regressive.
So you've told us in your book that there's two different ways to think about the American family in this context, the domestic and the patriarchal. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. I think that the Republicans' argument about the tariff and its impact on the family is deeply grounded in what historians would call domesticity, this model of a family in which women play a central role. And really, this is the model in which women are put on the pedestal, you might say. Their job is to devote themselves to their children, devote themselves to charitable activities and to church. Really, this is a model of the family in which women are seen as better parents, better Christians, more moral, more sexually pure than men, which is really a striking change from the 18th century. If you go back further and look, women were not on the pedestal. It's in the 19th century that this kind of Victorian ideal emerges. And the idea was that women exercised influence. Now, you might ask, and in fact, women started asking, if women are so much better parents and so much more morally pure than men, why aren't they voting?
Because voting would dirty them. They would sully them. It's pretty clear.
Well, and there were actually a lot of women who articulated that argument. They said, we're better citizens without the ballot, that we are much better citizens if we are able to be unself-interested. And as soon as we get in and start looking for political jobs and votes and vote our interests. But you see women out there before they get the vote arguing for everything from white supremacy to pro-tariff to anti-tariff to a range of different things. And while they often claim that they're unself-interested because that's the best way to advance their arguments, women have economic interests just like men do.
So if the Republicans tended to be associated with this domestic model of the ideal family, what about the other version, what you call the patriarchal model?
The patriarchal model of the family is very much based on the household head being in charge. And in party politics, it drives this idea that government is bad because it intrudes on or erodes the privileges of the household head. And I think that's a very powerful theme in anti-tax rhetoric. It's also a theme in protests against the draft during the Civil War. And obviously, it's a major part of the argument to defend slavery because the government can't come in and interfere in a branch of domestic law, and in a whole other array of things, defining something like marital rape there's a range of really obvious ways in which the question is how much role should government and law have in coming inside the household and reordering or regulating domestic relationships. Those people who believed in the domestic family said, look, government can help make the family better. When a husband or father is abusive or in some way the household isn't working the way it should, government can help. Those people who were defenders of the patriarchal family said, government should just stay out of our business.
That's Rebecca Edwards, a professor of history at Vassar College. She's the author of Angels in the Machinery, Gender and American Party Politics from the Civil War to the Progressive Era.
What I find really fascinating about Rebecca's interview, Ed, is the notion of protection and protection of family. You know, what's being protected, of course, is manufacturers, and we know who benefits from that. But that notion of protection it can take on many different forms, and it really can ultimately protect the home.
And Peter, you know, to talk about protection is to enumerate threats.
Exactly.
And one of the big threats that emerges at the end of the 19th century is the large corporation, the large trust. And one of the central arguments offered for the emergence of the trust and its destructive impact on the family is this protective wall of the tariff.
Yeah.
And at the very same time, progressives are beginning to offer an alternative, and that alternative is called the income tax. And in 1913, we get our first national income tax. There's only one problem, which is very few people paid that income tax. It was only paid by the wealthiest of the wealthy.
Well, Bryant, believe it or not, I have word that there is a listener anxious to talk with us about the income tax. Let's go to the phones. Our first caller today is joining us from Cary, North Carolina, and it's Douglas. Douglas, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
What's your question?
Well, my question is, why did the founders initially forbid the federal government from collecting taxes directly from the people? And why did we change that in 1913? how much power does that give the federal government over us that the founders didn't want them to have?
Ooh. Okay, great question. Why didn't the founders give the federal government direct tax power of the people? And I got bad news for you, Douglas. They did give that power. It wasn't in the form of the income tax, of course. That's a later development. But there was a provision for the possibility of direct tax, provided it applied equally throughout the states.
And what this meant was that if X percent of the population lived in Virginia, Virginians could not be taxed for more than X percent.
Yeah. And the deeper question, what people are always concerned about in the antebellum period, is the status of slaves and slave property.
Mm-hmm.
A tax on slaves by the federal government, of course, would be a wonderful revenue stream. This is the most lucrative property in the entire country. Why not tax it? But if you did, all the free states, or the states that are becoming free, would essentially be free riders. So in a way, this is a constitutional bureaucratic snafu. The federal government has the direct tax power, but it can't actually use it because it's so difficult to discover a mode of taxation that's not going to fall disproportionately.
So why do we need the 16th Amendment then in the early 1900s?
But before we get there, Doug, we got to take a stop in Ed's century. Because Ed, if I'm not mistaken, that income tax was first tried out in your century.
Yeah, you're right, Brian. When the Civil War comes, it is so unimaginably expensive and so many orders of magnitude more expensive than anybody had ever seen before that they really had to imagine new kinds of taxes, they being the North. And one idea was the idea of taxing people who had the most money proportionally to the amount of money they had. And this ended up being the income tax. So it was one of the great acts of innovation during the Civil War, but they got rid of it as fast as they could as soon as the war ended. Which I think could fit into what I take to be the spirit of your question, which is, isn't this kind of un-American, really? I mean, if they'd really wanted to have done it, they would have done it when it wouldn't just be triggered by an emergency. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that's part of it. I see a lot of the power of taxation is, particularly lately, Congress has used the power of taxation to punish people like the AIG executives when they imposed a 90% tax on those bonuses.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that was grabbed during war power. And I felt like the founders didn't want the federal government to have that ability to tax people right away. And then we changed that.
Well, I think if we're going to really get into the substance of the 16th Amendment, getting away from having to have taxes that are proportionate to the mm-hmm. distribution of people in mm-hmm. the population.
Right, right.
Then I think we need to talk about the growing role of the national government and the need to fund that role.
Absolutely.
And in the simplest terms, Douglas, I think it has to do with America's increased continuous engagement with the world in a proactive, positive way. Of course, we were always involved with the world through trade. But now we lived in a world of nation states that were competing militarily in increasingly threatening ways. Also, the national government was doing all kinds of things that it hadn't done in the early 19th century.
Right.
It was worried about forest fires in the national forests. It was constructing irrigation for those people moving out west who wanted to be good Americans and mm-hmm. to be able to farm. And so it did require an amendment to allow for the possibility of an ongoing revenue source that would not be simply the matter of exigencies like war.
Right.
So, Douglas, that was quite the flotilla of artillery that we've unleashed at you there. I'm just curious why you're asking this and if just exactly how much we've persuaded you with all this erudition.
Well, the reason I'm asking, I think a lot of it goes into the states' rights and the 10th Amendment argument that we're seeing now on
the
Tea Party
mm-hmm.
movement.
Mm-hmm.
How much power would the federal government really have if it didn't have this continuous revenue source?
Yeah.
And how much would it be if we had left a lot of like the forest fires and the education and the roads to the states?
Yeah, but you know, there's a slippery slope that way, Douglas, and I think mm-hmm. that's the thing to think about. The slippery slope is this. If the national government is impotent and can't do anything, and I give you the Articles of Confederation, then you have the possibility not only that the states are going to take care of forest fires, education, and the police powers generally, but they're going to be armed and they're going to be prepared to make war, guess what, against each other. You know, suspicion about the abuse of tax powers really is a question about the need for government itself. And in some ways, anti-tax people have a sense that we don't need the state. Southerners, for instance, in the antebellum period, didn't want to pay those import duties because they were in favor of free trade. And they thought the existence of governments was what was causing war. In fact, very, you might even say idealistic, utopian in their notion of a world without governments. Of course, that was a world that also was a world based on racial slavery, I have to point out.
The point being is that what you see is the people who are skeptical of government are people who believe that they've got it made in the market. And white Southerners said, look, we don't need no freaking government. We're handling this ourselves. We're providing these enormous exports that are driving the entire developed world's economy. Let us be free. And so, you know, there's always this dichotomy in American ideology between fairness and freedom. And this is another example of that.
Right. Thanks for calling, Douglas.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. The tax man's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on the sunny afternoon.